Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
This is the UR Tennis Network. We are the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate tennis enthusiasts who promote our sport relentlessly. We strive continuously to bring news and information for players, parents, coaches, officials, businesses, and anyone else who loves tennis. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis may not be interested in them.
Good afternoon, everybody in the tennis world. This is Bruce Lipka coming to you on Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network today. Today we have a special treat on our show. We have the one and only Craig Tiley, known as one of the greatest college coaches in the history of U.S. college tennis, and as far as I'm concerned, best tournament director in the history of a Grand Slam. We're going to jump real quick to a commercial. When we come back from the commercial, we'll be on the air with Craig. Stay with us.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to the show, folks. Here we are with Director of Player Development down in Australia and Tournament Director for the Australian Open. So that's the only Australian music I could get a hold of here. Craig, you with us today?
I'm with you. I can hear you loud and clear.
Well, I couldn't find any South African music where your roots really lie, so I had to go with something Australian, which is currently where you're taking care of business.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, it's good to be down here. It's a Thursday morning our time, so I know we're a different day to where you are in the U.S.
Well, we can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming on, and, you know, let's go ahead and jump right in. We've had a great deal of interest. We're always asking our listeners who they'd love to hear from, and your name comes up over and over, so we can't thank you enough for coming on the show and spending a little bit of time with us today. I know it's a busy time of the year as you're preparing for the Grand Slam of Asia there, the Australian Opens, but thanks for being with us.
No, it's a pleasure, Bruce. It's good to have a chat. Always good to talk tennis, and that's all I know, so it's an easy conversation.
I'm with you. Well, let's jump right in, and let's talk about your tennis roots, your introduction to the sport. Where was that in your native South Africa, and how'd you take to the sport?
Well, I was a late starter to tennis, but I developed a very quick love and passion for the game, and I've done nothing else in my life other than the sport, probably every day of it. But I only started around the age of 13, 14, and my great uncle introduced me to tennis, and he would, growing up in South Africa, he would travel a long distance. We would meet, and he would teach me how to play. And then I was introduced to a coach. Her name was June Melville, and she got me more interested in the game. And I think my love of the game started with the people that were around it, my great uncle and my first coach, who had a great passion for the game, and I learned that from them. And so I was very lucky to start play. I played national junior tennis, and then was on the South African professional tennis circuit as well, and traveled to Europe and played a little bit of tennis. But I always knew that that I was never going to be the player that I dreamed about being. But I was very comfortable with that, and always knew my place in the game, and really had a strong desire and passion to coach and to teach and to help others with the game. And I think that was transferred from the early learnings I had with my first coach and my great uncle, Uncle Bill, we called him, and he was fantastic getting us to love the game.
Well, it's a common story. You know, a lot of the folks we talk to who give back so much to our sport and love the sport so much, whether as a player, as a coach, they all seem to have had the fire lit, the passion lit early in life by someone close to them, and I guess those are the kind of gifts we can never repay. That's good stuff. So you're in South Africa, and you went to college in South Africa, where, of course, they don't have the college tennis system like we have here. And, you know, what were you doing, and how did you end up coming to the U.S.?
Well, it was a case of actually being in Europe at the time and playing some of the money tournaments in France. And then I applied to go to Tyler Junior College. I heard of a person there named by the name of Steve Smith, who was running a world-first program that taught those interested in tennis how to become coaches and teachers of the game. And I thought that would be great. Go there, go to the college, spend 2 years at the college, and you know, go through a formal education on being a tennis coach and a tennis teacher, and then go from there on and get a you know, further progress a postgraduate degree. I had already a degree in South Africa, which I had done after I just before I went to the army. I went to the army for 2.5 years, so I had about a 5-year window where I was doing college, playing university tennis, doing a degree, and then having to go to the army, and then also represented the South African Army in tennis as well. So then move over to the U.S., move over to Europe, and then from Europe on to the U.S., where I went to Tyler Junior College in Tyler, Texas. And that was really a defining moment for me, really knowing that I had this great passion to teach the game and coach the game and wanted to be the best possible student of the game. And I was fortunate to be around some good people. Steve Smith is a fantastic, really innovator in the sport and had a tremendous knowledge of the sport of tennis, and learned a lot from him in that journey. And then went on and got my degree at the University of Texas at Tyler, and then went to get my doctorate at the University of Illinois, and that's how I ended up there.
Well, let's rewind for a second, because there's a part of your story there that, you know, I'm getting old, I don't remember things too well, but I knew that you'd had time in the Army. I totally forgot about it. What was that like, you know, being a tennis guy, playing in the Army, you know, the discipline, the rigor? What were you doing on a daily basis? What went on during your Army experience?
Well, the Army experience was interesting. Obviously, it was the time it was compulsory conscription in South Africa just before independence, before 94, when Nelson Mandela became president. And it was a great move for our country at that time, South Africa, to have a peaceful transition. But being in the Army, I did a 9-month basic training, they call it, and that's where it's really rough. You're in the infantry, and they stick you out in the bush in the middle of all the skirmishes, and then I was selected to be an officer. So I went to officers training for another year, and then became an officer in the Air Force, became a lieutenant. And at the same time, I was around there still trying to use it as a platform to train. During the 9 months of basic training, I couldn't really hit any tennis balls because that was physical training, but I did get in great shape and learn a lot of discipline. Sometimes it's very painful, but when I look back at it, it was a tremendous learning experience. And there's no substitute for, you know, growing up with being exposed to pushing yourself and being in disciplined environments. I think that prepares you for everything else in life. And at the time, it was a very tough experience, those 2.5 years. But when I look back at it, it was probably the most defining moment and the defining experience I could have. So I look back at it with a great deal of respect.
Do you feel like that? The experience in the Army, did you take something you learned in officer training school, becoming an officer, being a leader of men, did that contribute to you being as successful you were when you became a college coach?
Yeah, no question. I mean, I understood a few things. One of them is that you can push yourself a lot further than you ever think you can, and you never find it out until you actually do it. And fortunately, in the Army, you're in a position where you're forced to do it, so you have no choice. The second thing I learned, if you have too many choices, people generally will take the easier route and not the tougher one. And again, the Army teaches you to take the tougher one. And the third thing I learned, that if you don't have certain rigor, discipline, and routine, around everyday life, it's very hard to progress. And I've taken those three real principles that I learned in the Army through with me every day in life. And even today, I'm not afraid of work. I'm not afraid to take risks. I'm not afraid to do the extraordinary and not afraid to push through the point of pain to get an outcome, whether it be mental or physical or whatever, because I've had that experience and I know it can be done. And I think the learning to become a great tennis player is a lot of people miss the opportunity. They look too often to the easy, it's blame versus responsibility. It's easy to blame the opponent, blame the weather conditions, blame the fact that you weren't selected, blame the coach, blame the parents. Same thing with the parents. You need to blame some other external circumstance. But at the end of the day, you take responsibility for what you do each day and for your actions, then ultimately you'll be successful.
Well, it's interesting because this is a common theme that we have from folks who are really doing some great things out there in the world. We just had Paul Goldstein on here last week, and that's all he talked about was accountability and responsibility. So I think we hear a common theme among those who succeed, and that's, I think, what folks need to hear. I think it's what the kids need to hear. There's no excuses. There's just accountability and responsibility. So at the time, you show up in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois to get your Ph.D., and you're going to teach a little tennis. Did you have any idea what college tennis was all about when you got there, and the plan was maybe to get involved and help with the team, or did this all come out of left field?
No, it came out of left field. I had no plan to do that when I got there. And I met the athletic director, Ron Gunther, at a dinner one night. And at the time, he was in the process, or he had just been appointed athletic director. He was in the process of making some coaching changes. And he knew a bit about my background. And I got a call from him a few days after that, and he asked if I was interested in being the interim coach at the University of Illinois until they did a national search, because it was halfway through the year where the previous coach had moved on, and so I agreed to do that. And I said the deal I'll make is that if you pay for my doctorate, I'll be the interim coach for you until you do a national search. And I didn't know what an SAT or an ACT was. In fact, at the time, I thought that 19 on the ACT was brilliant, so I had no idea. But I thought it was out of 20. But I think not having the knowledge of the detail, I think, really helped me, because I was inquisitive to find out. I was willing to learn. I wanted to listen to others, and that was January 1993, and I fell in love with coaching immediately. And I remember that there was a team of 17 players at the University of Illinois, and the only thing I knew how to do was to really work hard. So I remember I told the team that we'd be practicing at 5 o'clock the next morning, my first day on the job. And of those 17 players, I think only 11 or 12 showed up at 5 o'clock that next morning. So
there's your team, huh?
That afternoon when I saw it. Well, that was the start. The other five or six I told them that afternoon, they weren't part of the team because they weren't willing to make the commitment. And we kept with the 5 o'clock practice in every day for about 2-3 months. And then by the middle of the season, we were down to 5 players, which was a real problem because you have to have a team of 6. But we were willing to lose at number 6 because I think it was the beginning of setting a culture and setting a standard that the Illinois tennis was going to be all about. And in fact, there were a few matches. I'd asked the wide receiver on the football team if he would bring a racket and just be a body for us. And he was actually a pretty handy player. I played under 6 for us a few times, but we didn't many matches down there at 6. But that first year, I remember the record clearly. We played 27 matches, and we won 4, and we lost 23.
Yeah, a lot of folks got their shots in that year that weren't going to get shots at you in the future. But it sounds like when you started off, and correct me if I'm missing the mark here, it sounds like you started off with a desire to create a culture, to teach an attitude, to prepare kids for life, and if you did that, the winning might take care of itself as opposed to getting the job there and deciding we're going to just worry about winning. Is that kind of accurate?
Well, Bruce, you know that. I mean, we played against you a few times in Miami of Ohio, and you had the same attitude. Now, you had great teams in Miami of Ohio. You always had very disciplined kids and were always the toughest teams to play, and I always respected the work that you did there. And I think college tennis misses your good work in coaching. But there's no question that that was the approach. It was really all I knew. I mean, I didn't get caught up in all the peripheral stuff like who's on the schedule and who plays who and what position you play in the lineup and how good you are and whether you're many different things. I didn't get caught up, and that's all the peripheral stuff. I got caught up in the core. The core was that: were you disciplined? Were you willing to work hard? Did you want to become a tennis player? Were you willing to go to the classroom and take care of your academics? And were you driven to be successful? And if you didn't have those ingredients when I started on the team, we certainly taught you those and forced you into that situation, because if you didn't, then you were moved out of the team. And then we recruited for those ingredients. So, once they did it, at the time, after being there about 5 months, the athletic director came to me and said, look, we're still going to do a national search. We'll interview you for the job if you really want it. You probably have a heads up or a leg up. And I said, okay. And I went for the job and I got it. And that was the beginning. And as part of the interview process, I wrote a 10-year plan. And in the 10 years, I made a commitment, and I probably was naively made a commitment. I said, oh, we'll win the national title. We'll win the Big Ten title every year. And and I probably said that naively, because I just thought that if I took care of business as far as the work ethic and the attitude went, that the winning would take care of itself. But it turned out to be true. And it was less than 10 years that we did win the national title. And I think we won eight straight Big Ten titles.
I remember a conversation with one of the other coaches in the Midwest. I won't say his name. And I told him, I says, yeah, Illinois's got this new coach this year, and I spent some time with him. And you guys better get your heads up here. And he said, nah, Illinois's not that good. You can't really win. And I says, yeah, hey, these guys have been practicing at 5 in the morning. I don't see you getting up at 5 in the morning to go to the bathroom, let alone get your team out in practice. So anyone who's willing to make that sacrifice, I think they could be awfully good. And I think folks were not really, he's never coached before. He doesn't really necessarily know what he's doing. And I love hearing that kind of talk. That talk thrills me to death, because I think that a lot of guys buy into mediocrity, and the mediocrity, the example's there. I'd always wondered why team in the big...
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
You're saying you always wondered why no teams in the Big Ten?
Yeah, why no teams in the Big Ten with courts, facilities, money, fantastic educations weren't vying for national titles? One year Michigan was kind of solid and folks were real excited about it, and I thought to myself, boy, these guys all have 4.5 scholarships, great educations, in-state kids who work hard, they've got facilities. They play all each other. You drive to the schools, you play. You don't need a lot of money. It's a great schedule. Why aren't they winning more? And when you took over, why weren't these guys? Why did it take you to shake up the apple cart? What did you know that no one else knew? What did you do that no one else did?
Well, I think the first thing is I was surprised in the conference of time where everyone was thought winning a Big Ten title was a big deal, and I didn't think that at the time. I thought winning the national title was the key, and the Big Ten title was just one of the steps in the pathway to doing that. I think I was fortunate in that I wasn't influenced by, maybe by the history of it or the expectations. I was really just influenced by what I thought needed to be the pathway, and I was fortunate that we had a great athletic director. Ron Gunther was fantastic. We had a great institution, the University of Illinois, the best in the world. And I think it was just very fortunate to be at the right place as well. And there were some crazy things we did. We put a 10-year plan up. People thought that was crazy. I said we will only offer scholarships to American players, which we did. We had some foreign players on the team and players out of the United States, but we had a commitment to, the year we won the national title, went undefeated, was a team of all American players. People thought that was unrealistic. I said we could win the national title in the Midwest, in the cornfields of the Midwest. People thought that was unrealistic. I said we could raise money where we endow all the scholarships and endow the head coach and the assistant coach's salaries, and we build these fantastic facilities. People thought that was unrealistic. So I think I was more challenged by the fact that people said you couldn't do it. I'll never forget clearly there was a coach in the Big Ten who who we played the first year when we were really bad. We lost 2-7-0, and Arthur said to me that, good luck at Illinois. I don't really think you're going to get it done because Illinois has never been very good. They've always been at the bottom of the Big Ten, and there's no facilities. It's really cold, and generally it's got no history and tradition in tennis. And I enjoyed that conversation because it just added motivation. And it wasn't long before we beat that team and for 9 years never lost to that team. So I think, there's certain things that motivate you. That was in a small way with some of the things that did. But at the end of the day, the program was always focused on long-term development, never, ever took shortcuts. And the moment an athlete for the program took a shortcut, that's when we were going to lose. And there were times we did take shortcuts and we did lose, and we learned from that. And that's important, too. When you look back at it now, it looks like a fantastic 11-year run, and it was. But it was hard work. Many sacrifices had to be made, and we couldn't take any shortcuts. And having the discipline of doing that day in and day out is not easy. And I think you just got to stick to your guns, and good things happen.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I think I have a good eye for some things, and some things, Craig, I have no clue. And I remember when the job came open, I was at Miami University, and we had our place we drove 40 minutes to go play, and we had our two scholarships and our $500 recruiting budget, and that job opened at Illinois. It was the first Big Ten job that had become available when I was at Miami, and I thought to myself, my God, what a great job that is. That would be unbelievable. And called a guy, and he said, you can't win at Illinois. I was trying to convince the guy, are you out of your mind? And I couldn't have been happier when they hired you. Of course, I would have liked to have been hired, but they hired you. You took over. Within 5 years, you're just knocking it out of the park. And I went up to the fellow at the ITF Regional Indoors, and I said, I thought you couldn't win at Illinois. And I lived through you a little bit. I want you to know that I got great pleasure living through you because you proved everyone wrong, even though I couldn't do it. But what changed all of a sudden to go from being, to go from having the Gavin Sontags and the Jared Snyders and those fellows of the world, Matt Snyder, sorry, and these kids to getting a class of kids with Stolt and Calkins and Delek and Ram. I mean, that's a big jump in talent level. What did you figure out about recruiting all of a sudden? How did you get those kids to come?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can tell you in recruiting, I was the first one at the court, and I was the last one to leave, and I knew that to recruit the best athletes to come to Illinois, you've got to beat the Stanfords and the USCs and the UCLA of the world and the Georgias, and those four teams dominated college tennis for 100 years, and I know the only way you can break into their ranks was to beat them at their game, and their game was recruiting. And then, of course, two things: beat them at the game of recruiting and beat them in the game of coaching. And so what we sold is we sold long-term development. We sold the opportunity to become a professional tennis player. We sold the opportunity to improve every day. It wasn't about, it wasn't about being in the Midwest in the cold weather and where there's no nice city and bars to go to and an ocean to swim in. It was about a daily grind and becoming a great tennis player. So we had the right product to sell, and then it was just being relentless in work ethic. And I made sure that I just outworked every person next to me. And if it was through recruiting Amir Delek, Bruce Burke, who now the head coach at Michigan, is doing a fantastic job, and Bruce was my assistant during those great years, and he too had the same philosophy. So it was. And did a tremendous job for the program, and won the shining light for the program as well, as was our staff. Like everyone that was involved, whether it be our strength and conditioning staff, to the academic staff, to Jan Glosser, who's our administrative assistant and really executive assistant for the program. Everyone bought into the journey of success. So wherever an athlete turned, whether it be in the classroom with the academic advisor, whoever, they were part of the team. So when it came to winning titles and winning rings, everyone got a ring, not just the team. When it came to celebrating success or going on a trip, everyone did it. And I just found a way to make it work because I knew that you're limited with the NCAA rules on how much time you can practice during the week, and you stick within those parameters and those boundaries, but it's what happens outside of that. Who's talking to kids? What's the conversation that's going on? And if you get everyone on the same page, moving the same direction, it starts to happen. And then players like Amir Delic that came on recruiting trips, they saw that. This was one big family that had one goal in mind, that was to be great. And that's what they wanted to be part of. And so I think together, two things. One is creating an environment that is all about success. People will figure that out. Number one, with no shortcuts and having a long-term focus. And then number two is just working hard. And outside of that, I don't know any other magic formula because I don't think there is. And everyone looks for the magic dust. I see that the whole day, and that with my role now with parents and kids. Everyone, you know, today's society is everything is easy. You know, you can pick up a phone. If you don't want to talk to someone, you send them a text or an email, and everything is easy. And the struggle now is to create everyone wants it, but no one needs it. So it's when you need it. In Illinois, we needed it. We never had it, and we needed it. So day in and day out, that's how we live.
Well, it was awfully impressive. You had a phenomenal run there. Then I don't think anybody saw. You know, I remember there were a couple jobs came open. One was at Tennessee and a couple other places, and we had some conversations about some opportunity, and you didn't really seem to be interested to leave Illinois. And then all of a sudden, next thing you know, what happened? You got a call from someone in Australia, a headhunter. How'd that all come about?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we had the 10-year plan, and then all of a sudden we hit 10 years, and I looked back and I said, wow, you know, we've had a great 10-year plan. We stuck to the plan. When I wrote in 1990, end of 93, beginning of 94, I said by 2004, this is what we're going to accomplish, and it happened. We won a national title, undefeated for the year. We won several national indoor titles. We won 8 straight Big Ten titles. You know, and I think, and we had individual national champions, NCAA champions, singles and doubles, and at one time we had 8 players ranked on the world tour, in the ATP, and of those, several of them were in the top 200. So we had a great team. In fact, our team was better than most national federations before. So when I got to the end of 10 years, I kind of looked back and said, well, I haven't thought about the next 10 years or what the next gig is and whether it's the same thing, coaching and trying to keep the Illinois program dominant and would that be something that challenges me personally and professionally. And while I was thinking about that, I did get a call from a headhunter and said that they were looking for someone to direct the national program in Australia. I had no ties to Australia. Didn't really know anyone in the country, and I'd only been to Australia a few times for the Australian Open. And so I looked it up. I thought, well, this could be an interesting opportunity. So I did inform Ron Gunter at the time that I was going to step down as the head coach. I was disappointed at the time because I had made a commitment to some athletes. You know, G.D. Jones was one, and Kevin Anderson, and a few others that I'd made commitments to that have gone on and done really well in their careers, right at the heart. Promoted to be a, it was a good crop. They went on the year I left, that same year they made the finals of the NCAA, so they continued their journey of success, which is, I was happy for them. This was an opportunity to, you know, try something different, take the principles that I know and learn into an environment and try and have some success. I knew Australia was in bad shape in 2005. They only had 3 players in the top 200, men and women. They were in the worst cycle they had ever been in the history of their sport, and there's a lot of great history, a lot of great legends from Australia: Rod Laver, Roy Emerson, Margaret Court, long list.
Mr. Hopman himself.
Anyway, sorry.
Mr. Hopman himself. I spent some time with Mr. Hopman, and boy, you know, there's an Australian tradition that you can't really beat. Greatest coach ever.
Absolutely. Yeah, Mr. Hopman himself. I think, you know, a great history and tradition. So I took the job, came down, was the director of player development for the country. I had a funny accent, South African / American accent, and the Australians. I was the first ever international appointment in their sport. Normally, they'd always had their own running it, and they were looking for someone independent of that, and looking for someone on the outside. And I think so. I fitted the mold for them, within 6 months of being here, I think they liked my work, and I put a 10-year plan in place here, which we started then in 2006. So we're 3-4 years away from finishing that plan. And at the same time, they asked me to be in charge of the whole of tennis, not just athlete development, but participation, the Australian Open, anything to do with tennis, to be in charge of the whole thing. So that'll be great. I'll do that too. I don't know much about all that stuff, but I'll learn as we go, and I'll have a good attitude about getting a great team together and everyone have a tremendous work ethic and have a very clear plan of attack of how we're going to get to the outcomes. And, we've been on a good journey, and I'm very, very pleased, to be able to report and say back is that's a tremendous journey of success. We've had a player win a Grand Slam title, Sam Stosur, the U.S. Open, 2011, and when I started, we had three players in the top 200, three players in the top 250, and today we have 18. So, and the great thing about it, too, is the number one ranked 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20-year-old in the world for their age on the ATP and the WTA Tour Australia. So we're, so the future's good. Those players will really, they'll realize their dreams in a few years' time, and they'll look back at, I think, at again, that successful 10-year stint where there was a very specific plan.
Well, I want to pause for just one second. We got to play a commercial real quick, and when we come back from the commercial, I want to pick it up right where we are, talking a little bit about those younger players coming up and how that all came about. So stay with us for about 60 seconds, folks. Craig, just stay with us for about a minute. We're going to run a quick commercial, and we'll be right back. This is Craig Tyler today, is our guest today on the Bruce Lipka Show. Stay with us, folks.
This is Jason Haynes, the UR Tennis Network's Chief Executive Officer. Over the last 14 months, we have undergone a lot of changes here at the UR Tennis Network, and the Nike Tennis Camps have been one of our strongest supporters. They have had a very successful 2012 summer camp season and now are planning for 2013. We would like to thank them for allowing us to be an advertising avenue for their tennis camps. As we leave the summer, we want to encourage you to check out www.ussportcamps.com and start planning your next Nike camp experience. They have locations all over the U.S. for both adults and juniors. The Nike camps are offered in other sports such as golf, volleyball, soccer, swimming, softball, running, water polo, lacrosse, and field hockey. We want to encourage you to consider the Nike camp experience for your tennis needs. These camps are run by successful tennis coaches and offer a fun camp involvement where you learn new skills and make new friends. Be sure to check them out at www.ussportcamps.com or call them at 1-800-NIKE-CAMP and take your game to the next level.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. This is Bruce Lipka coming to you today from our nation's capital with Craig Tiley, who's coming to us from Down Under. Craig, when we left off, you were talking a little bit about some of the young players that you guys have in the pipeline down there. When you got to Australia, there's a lot of folks who feel like, we're underperforming here in the U.S. tennis-wise, which we'll get to, but certainly in Australia you had the tradition, you have the weather. What did you do to turn it around? Where did it come from? What is it, the step one of your plan?
Well, I think very similar to what happened at the University of Illinois. I mean, the step one is to have a plan. And so it took about 3 months to go through. It was a tough first 3 months because I was given a mandate for change, so we had to move some people on, bring some new people in. But we developed a plan, a clear strategic plan, 10-year plan on where we wanted to be as a nation, not only from a performance point of view, but from a participation point of view, an events point of view. And so step one is to have the plan. Step two is to have the right people that can execute on the plan. And then step three is to stick to the plan. No different if you want to learn how to hit a forehand or if you want to become a great tennis player, have a plan, have the right people, coaches, staff, whatever, around you to help you execute that plan. And number three, stick to the plan. And that involves hard work, discipline, making sacrifices, being committed, all those cliches you hear, which become cliches if you don't execute on them. So it was really pretty simple. So we did that, wrote that. I got unanimous support for that. And, there are times where a player loses and,
first round of a Grand Slam that they shouldn't be losing because you expect them to win. And then the media don't like it, so they'll take a shot at you because it's a very public role. But at the end of the day, you don't respond to those short-term snapshots. You keep responding to how you're performing against your long-term plan because if you do that, then you're going to have not only sustainability, you will definitely have success. So we're beginning to enjoy that. The tournament, the Australian Open, has gone from strength to strength. We haven't been impacted by the global financial crisis, and we're three times as big now than we were 6 years ago. And we recently have invested $1 billion with partnerships with the government here, the state government, in upgrading the entire venue. So the Australian Open, I believe, is going to become the pinnacle event of the world, and is on a track to be that. And then the Australian players is a great position, and they're poised and positioned to become great players. There's no guarantees, obviously, but all you can do is provide the opportunity.
Sure. Do you have a junior system there that's similar to what we've got going on in the U.S., whether it's from the development or the tournament system, the ranking system, or have you reinvented it and are you doing some things that are a little different down there?
You know, I don't know the detail. The U.S. have a great deal of respect what happens in the U.S. and some good friends involved with the process there and the journey there. And look, at the end of the day, there's no magic formula. Everyone has an opinion. So what we've implemented here, and all I can talk to is, without making comparisons, can talk to what we do here.
Right.
Number one, as I said, at the very beginning, is we're going to no longer be opinion-led. We're going to be fact-based. So we will make decisions purely based on facts. We're not going to make decisions on people's opinions. Because someone was a former top 10 player, they have an opinion you should do it a certain way. That's an opinion. That may have worked for them, worked for everyone else. Or because a coach thinks you should hit your forehand with a full Western grip, if that may be an opinion. So everything has to be fact-based. So the first thing you got to do is now quickly go and get some research done that you can provide the facts. So what we did is we established a criteria for support. And the criteria is based on 30 years of world ranking, every week in the ranking, how players have progressed from Roger Federer all the way down to the 1,000th-ranked player each year, each week, over 30 years. We've taken that data, we put it into a matrix, and we were able to track how the Australian players are doing against that average data over 30 years. And that's our benchmark. And if you're tracking according to the benchmark, you get support. If you're not tracking, you don't. Really pretty simple. And how support defined? Well, it's not defined in handouts of money. Is our supports are all in resources. So we don't provide any cash grants or anything to athletes. If they want support, we have a private coaching network. We have training environments. We have physiotherapists and strength and conditioning coaches, and they can use those resources or not. They can do their own thing. But if they choose not to, that's fine. You know, they can fund their own journey. So we do engage in the private coaches very much. We have a network of about 150 private coaches that are all contributing to the ultimate objective of Australian players performing well, and we do support them and recognise them. And then we have a national network of coaches that are willing to travel, 25, 30 weeks a year. And that's hard, obviously, you've got young families. And Australia, as people find out, the bottom end of the world is far from everywhere. You can't get anywhere without being on a plane for 9-10 hours.
Right.
So it's not an easy place to get to. So the expense for our athletes to travel and get to an American player is tough. So we need to have a coaching network that's willing to travel and spend a lot of time on the road. So that's probably a little different. But working well, we've got great support from all the private coaches. About 3,500 private coaches running businesses in Australia, and many of them are part of our network of helping develop players, and we provide them with education. And one of the first things we did, we had a separate coaching body when I first started, and we bought out that coaching body, and we brought all the coaches together into one body, and which is funded by the National Federation, which is us, and we provide them all the education, professional development resources, to upskill our coaching network of professional coaches. And I know in the U.S. you've got the USPPR and the USPPA and the USPA and that stuff. We made it all one, and we just felt that was better way to for us all to benefit from each other and not get into political battles, which are counterproductive to the ultimate successful outcome.
Sure, I think that's a wonderful plan. It sounds like it sounds like you really have everyone pulling in the same direction as opposed to opposing each other, which is great. And what about the parents? How are you handling parents who have their opinions?
Well, parents, in my view on always is parents should be made not part of the problem, but shouldn't be viewed as part of the problem. They should be viewed as part of the solution. So at the end of the day, 24 hours in a day, if you're working with a 13-year-old kid, they may take 4 to 6 hours of tennis, the physical training, on-court stuff, the academics. So the other 18 hours, some of it they're sleeping, and the other they're around their peers and the parents. So the people who can have the biggest influence on the younger kids are the parents. So I think it's naive to think that the parents should not be involved. I mean, you can't avoid that. And so our approach has been that we are going to educate the parents as best as we can. Now, are we going to get it right? No, you'll never be 100%, because some parents are just not willing to go through an education or going through a journey. Most parents, the first time having their kids choosing a coach and having their kid experience that, it's the first time they've ever done it. And
right.
I think the parents forget that they're in many cases the most underdeveloped or least experienced in the development of a tennis player, and the coach is the most experienced. But the coach has to always be the hero. So we always focus our programs on the coach being a hero. But when our kids participate in any of our national events, there's mandatory parent education. And in order for the kids to participate, the parents have to go through the education. And then all our young talent development squads, which are under the age of 12, all those squads, the parents have to show up with the kids, and the parents are doing educational sessions at the clubhouse while the kids are out on the court. And we just do the best we can with that. There's still some parents that misbehave, but at the end of the day, if they cross the line of the code and the rules, they get sanctioned, or they don't, the kid gets sanctioned. And unfortunately, you lose some kids because the parents are out of line, but that's just how it's got to be. But for the most part, 99%, the parents are great. They're part of the solution. They're critical to the journey of the athlete, and support them. We don't pay parents to be coaches. We only support coaches to be coaches, and we want the parents to be the parents, but we want them to be part of the team, but an educated part of the team.
Well, I like this. I like your methodology a great deal. I've always been one since I left college, and I've been in the private sector. I always like the parents to come to the lessons. I like them to come to the skull sessions. I like them to come to the video reviews. So if they get the education that the players get, I feel like it makes for a more informed and a better companion, because they're the ones taking the kids to most of the tournaments. So, I applaud you on that, as opposed to a lot of places where, the signs say parents stay out, which has never really made sense to me.
Well, if you push the parents away, I'm a parent, and if you push the parents away, their natural inclination is they want to be involved. If you involve the parents, give them a lot of education information, they want to be less involved because they trust you. So, it's the same old adage. We all got enemies out there, and if your enemies are far away, you can't hit them hard enough. So bring them closer so you can whack them. It's the same approach, not that you want to do it with parents, but parents, you have to embrace them. They're part of the journey, and parents can be a huge benefit to the success of an athlete if they're doing the right things. And if they don't know what the right things are, they're not going to do them. And if they refuse to do the right things because they think they know better, that's fine. They can go off and do it. They don't have to be part of the opportunity that you offer.
Right. Well, then, so we fast forward there. You go down there and you're doing your thing, and all of a sudden, about 08, there's a rumor. USTA is looking for a head guy. They're going after you. Was that true, or is that just rumor?
There was a lot of truth to that, I can't say it's rumor because a lot of people listening will know there's truth to that. And my wife's American. She's from Chicago, and we love America. America is our home, and at some point we were looking at returning to the U.S. I just think at that point in time, it was too soon after being in Australia. We just started on this journey, and I am the person that likes to, and have always been loyal to, you know, those that provide an opportunity and believe that you need to finish something that you've started, and when you make a commitment, you complete it. And I think those decisions or that consideration was very more personal and professional, and I think that the process had gone very far down the track before made any final decisions on it. But there's some great people in the U.S., and I think there's a great opportunity in the U.S. to be a dominant nation in tennis. Many of our friends in the U.S., and we miss them, and I make a point of coming back 2 or 3 times a year to see family and also to see my good friends in the sport as well. And you're certainly one of them, Bruce. There's some great people that are making a huge difference to our sport. One of the things when we did start here in Australia is that the Australian public generally looked at college tennis as if you go to college tennis, you're a failure. And it's been one of the most things I've been most proud of here in Australia. We've been able to turn that attitude around to where college tennis is a critical part of our athlete pathway. And we actively encourage the Australian kids to go to college in the U.S. We have a system in place where we provide the college coaches with an opportunity to want to come and see the kids. We have special showcase tournaments where the college coaches can come and watch the kids. And we're about to launch our website where the college coaches can get profiles, which we've invested in. And we have 2 full-time staff members just working on supporting kids going to college, because I think college tennis in the United States is the best system in the world. And there's some great colleges and there's some great coaches, but there's also some not-so-great colleges, not-so-great coaches, but that's the 5,000 choices that an athlete has. So I think I'm proud of the fact we've been able to turn that attitude around where Australians now view college tennis as an important part of the pathway and a place where they can succeed if they do the right things. And I think that's where America's got a huge upper hand in tennis and in development. And if you add all the coaches' salaries and the budget for all of college tennis, you'd get over... My guess, you get over $1 billion in the sport of tennis just in the college system.
Yep. Well, it sounds like you might have been listening to my show with Emilio Sanchez last week, because he was saying that he thinks that with the average age of the top 100 player now being, you know, closer to 26, 27, then there's definitely a place in the college system, and it's a great place to go to mature and to develop your game.
Oh, there's no question. I think 99% of kids make the wrong decision about not going to college. Even if you went to college for a year or two, that's better than nothing. But ideally, you finish the journey in 4 years. But the discipline you learn in the college environment, when you've got to schedule your day for tennis practice, for all these other things, is critical to your future development. And that's right. On the men's side, average age of top 100 players is 27 years old. On the women's side, it's nearly 24 years old. And, 15 years ago, we got your first point, took on average about 2 years to transition to the top 100 when they got their first point. Today, it takes 5 years. So everything's a lot longer. Development's later, athleticism's greater. So why not? Unless you're an Andy Roddick or Sam Querrey, Serena Williams or Venus Williams, go to school.
Well, it seems like there are some folks that even if you were Andy Roddick, I guess there wouldn't be anything wrong with, if you tried school out, you entered in, January of the freshman year or tried 1 year, certainly doesn't seem like there's a downside to it. You can always give it a try, and if you outgrow it, you outgrow it.
Well, and you've got to make the right choices with the right coaches, and you've got to find something that suits you as an athlete. But, geez, what a fantastic system. I wish we had that in Australia. How great would that be? But we just don't have the infrastructure and the numbers and the history and the tradition like there is in college sports. My 11 years, close to 12 years at the University of Illinois, and my experience there will undoubtedly be the best time of my life. And I don't know, some of my best friends are athletes now that were in the program, have graduated and gone on to be very successful in their own right. And we're all getting together actually next year in Champaign, because it would be, we won the national title in 2003, so it'll be 10 years since we had that undefeated year. The entire program's getting together, and we've got so far 57 of our former athletes all showing up, and there's only about 90 that I coached during that window, and I think we'll probably have all 90 there eventually, so in May next year. So we're really looking forward to it.
That's fantastic. That's what you like to hear. So, you know, another rumor that started flying around, I read an article a couple years back about 2011, it seemed like about July, a fellow named Dave Wiskowski wrote an article on online on CBS that said Illinois could go down under for its next AD. And is that all just rumor, or is there any foundation there?
No, you know, the journalists often get things right. I love the University of Illinois, and I was called on it, and I did have a discussion, but was happy with my role here. I do hope one day maybe be able to contribute to the success of Illinois athletics in some form. I don't know whether that opportunity would present itself, but I love what I'm doing here and making a difference and a contribution here to Australian tennis. We're part of the 10-year plan, and we've been at it since 2006. It's end of 2012. Now we're in 2013, so it's been, it's a little more than 6 years, and there's a few more years left to finish the business. And I think that at that point we'll assess where we're at here and other things as well. But I feel I've got a lot more to give, and looking forward to what lies ahead of that.
Well, if you and I are sitting in a bar and we're having a beer and we're watching some sports on TV and we're speaking pretty openly about some things, you'd said before how, and I think a lot of people feel, I sure do feel like countries like the United States, Australia, these are countries that could be global leaders in sport and tennis, but particularly the U.S. What are we not getting right now? What can we improve upon that would help us become a leader again on the world stage in the sport of tennis?
Well, I think the U.S. is getting a lot right. I mean, I think the we always tend to look at what's wrong, and I think the great thing about the United States and the people of America, and I am an American citizen, a U.S. citizen, and the great thing about is that it's a can-do attitude. Anything is possible. You know, when someone does well in the United States, they get propped up, they get elevated to do even better. No one's there trying to bring anyone down, and I think that I think maybe the economy hasn't helped it, but when the conversation becomes negative and the conversation becomes accusational, and we move away from what made the nation and the sport great about, what can I do to help? How can we contribute? There's nothing wrong with being challenged. There's nothing wrong with saying, look, I think you can do this better, or, what are you doing here? But competition in America is the best in the world. There will never be, and there is not a nation, a country in the world that handles competition like the U.S. does, and I just think maybe that we've lost the edge a little bit on that, and I'm saying I'll compete with you, but what can I do to make you better, and what can we do as a team? Where's the team approach to advancing the sport of tennis? And I think when too many people get involved, too many opinions get into the system, I think that's problematic and challenging as well. I think everything's got to be fact-based. You got to go out and decide what the facts are, and everyone's got to get on board with the facts. There's no question the opportunity exists. I have no doubt American tennis will be dominant in the world. It always, anyway, does happen in cycles. So even if you do nothing, cycles always return.
Right.
I think there's a lot of good people, and I think the U.S. Open is a shining light as far as an event goes, and the team do their magnificent job running one of, arguably, the best sporting event in the United States. And that's been used to help promote the sport. Have some fantastic academies there. I mean, look at the history of Volotaris, and you just see the whole time. There's some great teachers of the sport. I mean, two great mentors and teachers of mine, Dennis Vandermeer and Vic Braden. Are global heroes when it comes to coaching and education, and it all is in the United States. I don't think it's so much about what the United States is doing wrong. Competition's changed, times are tougher. There's kids today are looking for easier options, More people in the world are wanting the opportunity and buying for the opportunity, and there's less opportunity. And so I think it's more that more of that happened than what's going wrong. And I think the U.S. should say, okay, so let's focus on what's going right. Let's put all the great assets we have, the great opportunities we have. Let's see how we can be a better team on delivering it. Will that deliver an outcome? Yes or no, but what it will deliver at least is a better opportunity and a great outcome. So, you know, I'm being probably vague in saying it without giving specifics on what it is, but I'm not close to it. I don't work day in and day out with that. So I'm not a person to be passing an opinion without the facts, without the knowledge. And and I think that if I was, I could be more specific. But I think as I said, it comes down to, Bruce, as you know, it's the same thing. And you had your successful college team, you might never hire. It always comes down to the people. And and you have good leadership, good people, you'll get good outcomes, regardless of what people think.
So you talk about fact-based. Let me ask you, there's an urban legend in the U.S. that I think is fact-based, that you guys down there did some sort of a study with kids under the age of 12 who played with yellow balls and played with green balls, and you videotaped it all, and you came to some conclusions based on which would be best, or it might have been 10 and under. I've not seen the study, but I've had several people reference it. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, so we have what we call hotshots. Now, hotshots is our developmental program under the age of 10, well, under the age of 12, really. Four different kinds of balls that the kids use. And in those kinds of balls, one of them is the regular ball as well. So there's a soft spongy ball for the under 6-year-olds. Then we go to an orange, a red dot ball for under 8-year-olds, and then 8 to 10 we go to a yellow dot ball, and then 10 to 12 a regular. So we found in that pathway, we want to get nets and balls out to every school, every club, every environment, put it out there, and just see what the kids do. See what they pick up, see what they hit, see where they have success, and one thing we found is that the kids generally, on their height, their size, their experience, picked up a ball that matched that. And so then we just said, okay, we did that 4 years ago, that's great, let's roll it out, let's provide the four options of balls, provide the rackets, provide the net. Spent several millions of dollars, got it into all the coaches, close to all the schools, and let the kids have a go and have a play, and don't try and mandate specifically what they have to do and how they have to score and what time of the day they have to play and what ball they have to use, and we've been pretty relaxed with that approach, because we wanted the consumer, the end user, the customer, to make the decision based on where they were comfortable. And within about 18 months, we had 360,000 kids sign up for that.
Wow.
So it went from nothing to wildfire. And our little hotshots program has grown into be the most participated in and most successful junior sport development program in the history of sport in Australia. And,
that's fantastic.
We haven't been at it for long, which is great. I mean, but maybe, we don't know, but maybe out of that group will come a great player because they love tennis and they're having some success. So we haven't been rigid on our definition of how you participate in hot shots. But because there are some kids that are, at 9 years old are great little players, and we've got this Destiny Aiva, and Destiny's 10 years old, and she can crack a ball from anywhere on the court. And she's playing against the 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds, but she's not using the red ball. She's out there using the regular ball. So I think it really depends. I think you've got to focus on the individual. You've got to see what the desires. We have a much easier opportunity. There's only 22 million people. The U.S. is over 300 million, so it's a lot harder. It's 22 million people, so it's a little easier to manage something like that. But our goal is to have 880,000 kids playing in that program by 2016.
Well, certainly the wider the base of the pyramid, the taller it can grow.
Well, that's exactly right. I don't think I don't think Jack's beanstalk had one little root in it. And,
nope, I don't think so.
You know, and I think that's the, and, yeah, and that's the attitude that we have, is that we're, we will push the envelope as much as we possibly can, and we'll provide as much opportunity as we possibly can, and just day in and day out, we'll just do the best we can. I'll never say that we're going to make all the right decisions, and I'll never say we're always right. But I will say that we're always willing to learn, we're always willing to listen, but at the end of the day, we believe we've got the facts to say that this is the direction we should be going.
Well, I think, you know, I think everything that you're saying here, I'm with you. I don't know what I know, but I certainly think it's fantastic. You know, as we wind down here, you know, I got an email here and from Dave Gatz, who said, ask Tylee any good books he recommends. Anything you've been reading or you've read recently that you recommend?
Well, I can recommend for your listeners one book, but for guests, I can recommend one specific book. No, I'm just kidding. I wouldn't want to expose the books I'm going to give guests over the airwaves. But he's a good man, and he's a good. I tell you what, it was always tough competing when he was a coach at the University of Minnesota. They were always tough teams to compete against because he did a good job, and like with you, I always knew we were up against it because I got most nervous playing you guys. But it was always a fun competition. You know, I think when it comes to reading. The books that I read, I love to read autobiographies. I want to know, not just in sport, but in business. I want to know what people's journey has been to success. My favorite book of all time is Teaching Young Children How to Play Tennis by Vic Braden. And that book, when it was written 20 years ago, was 20 years ahead of its time. And I think that if anyone can get hold of Tennis for the Future by Vic Braden, anyone get hold of any books that are written by Vic Braden in tennis, they gold. And that's been my tennis Bible, those books, really. Learning comes success comes from the willingness to learn, ask questions, because there's a lot of other people out there that know a lot more than I know or we know. And if a parent and a kid has that attitude, then there's no question they will progress. And I think you learn from others, and certainly autobiography success of others is some common denominators in people that have had success. One of them is humility. They're willing to take some knocks and take some hits and continue to move on. Another one is take risks. They're willing to take some big risks the third thing is no fear of failure. They will make mistakes, and if you can make a mistake, it's only failure when you repeat that same mistake twice.
Right.
But people are willing to make mistakes. And another one is work hard. And, that's the one that I really only know, just work your butt off. And then I think the fifth one is this common denominator that I've learned in the reading all these autobiographies of people is that willingness to learn. So, I take those with us every single day. I try and instill that on our team. We've got a large team. I have about 170 staff that I manage directly and a budget of over 100 million, so I have big responsibilities, but I keep it simple.
Well, we always like to finish those show up with what we call a little rapid fire. We give you a couple of quick questions. We look for some short answers. What is your greatest joy in life?
Winning.
Greatest fear?
Good question. I think... now that I've got a daughter, my greatest fear is that probably something happens to your kid.
Your greatest fear is my son dating your daughter?
No. Well, if my greatest joy is winning, I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Who are your real life heroes?
Well, my real life heroes probably in tennis have been Vic Braden. I think a man of a great deal of respect for. Ken Rosewall, Rod Laver, Roy Emerson, just some fantastic people in the sport of tennis. I've got to look at outside of tennis people, business. A person by the name of Jorge Paulo Lemann is in the top 50 in the Forbes Rich List in the world, and a man, a fantastic man, runs big businesses and based in Switzerland, originally from Brazil. So, you know, these are people that I look up to, and probably someone on a day-to-day basis that love their company. I'm very good friends with, and a great deal of respect for in tennis, Roger Federer.
Last question. Is there a motto that you live by?
Yeah, be good to people.
Well, that's an awfully good one. Craig, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. We appreciate it. One day, when they make a sleeping pill strong enough that I can sleep the whole way down there, I'll have to come visit you.
Well, they've got them out now, and they've got nice fancy planes with a little quicker. So you're welcome any day. And in fact, we are going to send an invitation to Division I coaches and the top 100 men, top 100 women teams, invite them to the Australian Open and provide them with accreditation if they come, not only recruit and come and enjoy some tennis. I'm about to send those letters out today. So as much as I can, keep supporting college tennis.
Well, I appreciate it, and you know, I look forward to seeing what the next great challenge on the horizon is going to be for you. And God, just love keeping up with what you're doing. Keep on doing it, and I wish you all the best down there.
Well, thanks, Bruce. Great to chat. Good to chat again after all these years, and we'll stay in touch. And you know, and I tell you what, it's having a radio talk show, so you're on to it. Doing a great job. Keep it up.
Well, thanks. If you think you can, I got Anna Cohn, we got Paul coming on here in about a week or so. We're going to talk a little bit, but you think you can get Roger to come on and talk to me for an hour, you let me know. I'd be happy to have him.
Hey, well, I think Paul's got a better chance of that than me, but we'll certainly ask him. But, you know, there's someone, you know, you're getting some good guests on us, and I'm you know, privileged to be around.
I just tell people I know you, and they come on the show.
No, I don't think that happens.
All right, all my best,
but
Craig.
Paul's
thanks again. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Great, thanks, Bruce. Good luck, and all my friends in the U.S. See you soon.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
All right, folks. That was Craig Tiley with us today. I mean, is there a better guy in tennis? What a great motto to go through life: be good to people. Folks, we hope you'll join us again on our next show next week. Stay with us here for our quick message at the end, and we're going to have some great shows coming up, and make sure you tune in and watch the Australian Open on TV. That's Craig's tournament. Have a good day. Thanks for listening to the Bruce Lipka Show, Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network.
Opinions stated by various contributors to UR10's radio and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR10's network. Visitors are urged to use their own discernment to draw their own conclusions. All information, products, services, and use of this website is for personal use only. UR10's radio does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of the information contained within the website. Any services or products provided by UR10's radio and its hosts or contributors should be used solely for entertainment and enjoyment. We emphasize the importance of keeping an open mind and not construing the data, products, and/or services as factual.